One of the first paid gigs that I got after moving to Los Angeles was as a researcher for the reality court TV show Judge Alex.
She was only looking to make some new friends.
I met him as a friend. He knew I was a lesbian.
But at some point, this friendship took a romantic turn, and the two now share a daughter together.
I was drunk.
My job was to go to courthouses across Los Angeles County, Beverly Hills, Compton, Torrance, West Hollywood, and pull the small claims case files, copy the information, and then send it to the show's producers. I saved a few of my favorites, like this one. Beverly Hills, case S01058. I went to Dr. Moitke for plastic surgery. I was shown pictures and told I would look a certain way. This was not the case. Dr. Moitke ruined my looks, took my money, and lied, suing for $10,000. Here's one more. Beverly Hills, case S0146. Defendant knocked off my glasses and stepped on them, suing for $500. Before I could look at any of these case files, I had to sign in at the courthouse. And the sign-in sheet was always filled with the names of researchers from other court shows. I didn't realize how cutthroat this world was until I received an email from my boss that said, quote, "Dear Judge Alex research team, it has come to my attention that some of the other court show researchers are bribing our Judge Alex researchers for cases. While you work for us, you cannot work on other shows, i.e. double dip, as A, it violates your deal memo, B, it's just not right, and C, karma can be a bitch." I started to wonder, how did we get here? Why was there a legion of daytime television employees stalking the halls of justice, battling each other over the petty disputes of people with mangled faces and broken glasses? So I went rogue and started doing a little research of my own. And I believe I have found the patient zero of daytime court TV, the Big Bang that spawned a solar system of celebrity judges. The one trial that started it all. From KCRW, this is Welcome to LA, episode 5, The Case of the Missing Sprinkles. It all started back in 1975 with a guy named Stu Billett. He was an ex-Marine working in game show development in New York City when this guy John told him about an interesting development happening out in California.
In California, they just that year decided to put cameras in the courtroom. So John's idea was, hey, let's pick cases, two or three cases, and we can record them, and then we'll take them, we'll edit them down, and we'll put them on television, you know, make a show.
So Stu spent the next few weeks hanging out in New York City courtrooms, watching trials, trying to figure out how to turn them into compelling television. It did not go well.
I mean, it is the dullest thing in the world. Lawyers are, you know, if they don't have Hollywood writers writing their stuff, it was awful. I mean, I literally saw judges sitting on the bench, you know, with their elbow on the desk and their finger under their eye, trying to keep them awake.
Stu was all but convinced that there was no way to turn these cases into a show that people would actually want to watch.
And one day, I was about finished with the whole thing, and I was walking out, and I saw a little sign, Small Claims Court. Well, I'd heard of Small Claims Court, but again, I'd never been. And I walked in, I sat down, and it was a small courtroom, and was hardly a courtroom. There wasn't a big desk. Most of the cases, the defendant didn't show up, and the guy won automatically. But one case, I remember, I'm sitting there, I was about to leave, and a case came up, and it was a, a little Jewish man was suing some street kid, a black African-American street kid. This old man bought some sunglasses from him and with sprinkles, he said, with sprinkles, you know, rhinestones. He called them sprinkles. And he got them home and all the sprinkles were off. And he had this thick Jewish accent. Oh, that's the front door. Sorry about that. Yeah. We can't do anything about that. Let us wait.
As we wait for the electronic doorbell to stop ringing, I glance to my right and am momentarily hypnotized by the deep blue water of the pool just outside the window. We're sitting inside the two-story back house behind Stu's beautiful Spanish colonial home in Beverly Hills. Stu's wearing sweatpants, a black athletic shirt, and slippers, which he has propped up on the footrest of a lazy boy. He looks good for 82. Anyway, so this old man buys some sunglasses from this kid, and each pair was covered in sprinkles. But by the time the guy got home, all the sprinkles had fallen off the sunglasses. So he went back to the kid and wanted his money back. And the kid said, no way.
And then they went to the kid, and the kid was in my honor, and he started showing his glasses off, and the judge said, look, don't sell your glasses here. I see the sprinkles. Why didn't you give him his money back? They all fell off. He said, well, because, Your Honor, when he bought them, I started to wrap each one individually and put it in a bag. That's how I keep it. And he insisted, no. He didn't want that. And he had a long way to go. And I tried to explain to him. He wouldn't listen to me. So I put him in one bag like he wanted. And Your Honor, ask him to raise his right hand. All right. The judge says, would you raise your hand, Mr. So-and-so? And he raised his hand.
And at this point in the story, Stu raises his hand, and it's shaking violently.
The man had palsy. That's the picture of him with the bag for 2 hours in the subway and the bus, shaking the three things. And when he got home, of course, they were all off. And I mean, everybody who were on the floor, it was so funny.
Now this was television gold. It was the kind of thing you could turn into a hit show. So Stu started pitching the idea to networks. And they thought it was shit.
One was somebody who worked for me and went to CBS and became head of daytime. He called it a piece of poo-poo. And he didn't use the word poo-poo. He said, that's a terrible idea. You know, that's awful. Forget it, Stu. Who cares about these people? I mean, there's stupid little cases about, you know, $750, $500, $200 case. You're crazy. Get off it, Stu. Go back. Create a game show, you know. I mean, NBC said to me, this will tear down jurisprudence in America if we put this on the air. I couldn't, you know, how do you argue that?
So Stu gave up on the idea of courtroom TV, and he decided to go out on his own and create his own company, Stu Billet Productions. And he wanted a flashy show to launch his new venture. So he came up with an idea called Fantasies Fulfilled. It was based on a previous show where celebrities had their fantasies turned into reality. Stu decided to tweak that idea. He asked regular people to send in their wildest fantasies, and he would make them come true.
And I found a great fantasy. Oh, God. It was a woman in Chicago wrote a letter in saying that she was, in her 50s, married, kids, whole thing. But ever since she was a little girl, she and her sister loved to dance. And the tango, they loved the tango. And her fantasy, she saw Cesar Romero doing the tango in a movie. And her fantasy was to dance the tango with Cesar Romero.
Cesar Romero was one of Hollywood's great actors. He made his debut in the 1930s. And became famous for his suave roles as a Latin ladies' man.
Vicky, Vicky, Vicky. I thought so. Time has only succeeded in making you more exquisite. Not a facsimile, but the real thing in the flesh.
And a couple of pounds too much of it. That was always one good thing about dancing with you, Victor. You were so strenuous, you kept me down to 110.
That wasn't the only good thing about dancing with me, I hope.
And he was also great at slapstick. He had a great physicality. His most famous role is probably as the Joker in the Adam West Batman series.
You and your trained exploding shark. Oh, quack! How should I know they'd have a can of shock repellent bat spray handy? Why, you sniveling sardine? Are you pompous, puffed up penguin? Our
friends may... And most importantly, Cesar Romero was a hell of a tango dancer.
So we got a hold of Cesar. Cesar said yes, you know. And we did the whole thing. Picked her up at the airport, brought her to Beverly Hills, got her a dress, got her a feather boa, had her hair done, took her to, you know, really did it up, you know. And then we went to the Chateau Marmont and we set it up there because the sunset at 6:30, it was a beautiful room and the sunset was coming. It was all windows. And when we rented the place and took the rug up and had the floor ready, everything was perfect. And Cesar came and we, Cesar sent her flowers, we interviewed her, did the whole thing fabulously. And just about a half hour before the sun was about to set, one of my producers came running over to me. Oh, so we're in trouble. He said, we got a problem with Cesar, you better come upstairs. I said, oh, he's drinking, you wanna? He said, well, he was taking pills and then the, you know, we had a glass of wine, but you got to come. I said, get some coffee, get a pot of coffee quickly, you know. He said, you got to come, you got to come. And say, so I go upstairs and I walk in and Cesar standing by the window looking at the sunset. And I said, Mr. Romero, this is our executive producer. And he turns around and says, Mr. Executive Producer, hello, 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 waving his hands. Well, in a million years, who thought that Cesar Romero was gay? I mean, Cesar Romero? And, you know, he looked at my face, he could see my face, and I'm thinking, this poor lady, she's had this fantasy for 50 years, and here he's going to come down to dance with her. She'll die. And he comes over to me, and he puts his arm around me, and he pinches my cheek, and he says, Mr. Executive Producer, look at me. He said, look at me. He says, I'm an actor. Don't worry. Well, we got her all ready. We set her up. We turned her music on. He came down the steps in this blue bolero jacket. You know, he looked great. He had white hair and a white mustache, looking fabulous. And he walked over to her and he grabs her hand and he says, Lucille, I've been waiting so long. And he kissed her hand and she went, oh, and she fainted into his arms. And he just picked her up and swirled around the dance floor, started dancing. And we looked down and the way where she was standing was a big puddle. She swooned. She peed all over the floor. Well, I wasn't going to stop. They were going, and I grabbed somebody's jacket, I don't know whose it was, and I threw it down and wiped it up and let them dance, and they danced. It was great.
Más te quisiera, más te amo yo, y toda la noche la paso suspirando por tu amor. Más te quisiera, más te amo yo, y toda la noche la paso suspirando por tu amor.
Stu was convinced that he had a hit with Fantasies Fulfilled.
Oh, the show was great. Everybody loved it. They just loved it. And I thought, that's it. I've made it, my first show, and this is going on the air. And I took my it wasn't my wife, but my girl who had two kids, and I had a son. We took the five of us to Hawaii. I spent every dime I had. We had this great vacation.
Turns out, the networks thought the idea was, as they say in the industry, poo-poo. Anyway, long story short, Stu resurrects his court TV show idea. And for whatever reason, this time, he got funding for a pilot. Bada bing, bada boom, he got a deal with ABC. And they called it The People's Court. They hired Joseph Wapner as the judge and host. And it was never a big hit, but the show had an unusual staying power. It lasted 12 years.
who thought it would go 12 years. That was very unusual. He usually had a show that lasted 2, 5, 6 years, and it went off.
In 1993, the People's Court went off the air. And almost immediately, a retired family court judge from New York City named Judy Scheinlin called up Stu's office and asked if she could be the new host of the People's Court. And they were like, nah. But CBS decided to hire her and create a new court TV show called Judge Judy.
Judge Judy is a phenomenon. I mean, in syndication, a 2.5 is a good rating, or was. And still is. Anybody had a 3 was a huge hit. She went on the air and immediately hit an 8 and changed television. Well, Judy's been making $40 to $45 million a year on that show for 20 years now.
Suddenly, there was a huge demand for reality court shows. Judge Mathis, Judge Alex, Judge Hatchett, Judge Joe Brown, Judge Karen, Judge Christina Perez, and former New York City Mayor Ed Koch became the host of the newly resurrected People's Court. But Koch only lasted 2 years before he was replaced by Judge Judy's husband.
He was a great guy, but he didn't have it either. He wasn't Judy.
Nevertheless, People's Court stayed on the air and eventually hit the milestone of 3,000 episodes.
And Warner Brothers, they always do this. I don't know why they spend all this money. It's so stupid. Make a cake, you know, with 3,000 on it and have all reporters and all cameras come. And they wanted the three judges, Wapner, Koch, and Scheinlin, to stand by the cake. It was stupid. And I'm watching this go on. And I look and I see there's three old men. How the hell did that happen, that I ended up with three old Jewish men on a show? So I called over my executive producers. I said, as of this minute, we are looking for a woman. Okay, she can't be a day over 40, a judge, and she's Latina.
Well, the person who actually approached me was Harvey Levin, and I came for an audition. And I kept hearing about Stu Billett, who was like the man behind the curtain. And when I auditioned, I did the first case. Everyone came out all excited, and they told me, Stu wants to talk to you. And I was so nervous. He gets on a speakerphone, and he says, hey, Marilyn, how you doing? And my first words to him were, I don't know, Stu. You tell me. How am I doing?
In 2001... Judge Marilyn Million became the first Latina to host a reality court show. 17 years later, she's the longest-running host of the People's Court. The day that Judge Million made her television debut, she invited her whole family over to watch.
I was too nervous to watch it. I was in the kitchen cooking stuff up for people. And when I walked back out into the living room, my brother looked at me and he said, it's you. It's all you. It's just a hell of a lot more of you. And that's kind of, you know, the theory behind these court shows is that I get paid to actually do the things I try to keep in check all of my life when I was on the bench in Miami. You know, like there was a judge at my going away who spoke and said, it's funny, I spent all these years telling her to just shut up. And now look at her, you know, she got this job because she wouldn't.
Before she was the host of the People's Court, Million was an assistant state attorney for Dade County, Florida. She was also a prosecutor and a criminal judge in Miami. Which means in the course of her career, she has decided whether or not a TV repairman should be reimbursed $100, and she has sentenced people to die.
I've actually met people like in a dark parking lot who say, are you Judge Million? And then I'll be panicking and hoping that I didn't send their relative to death row. And then they'll tell me, oh, I had a case in front of you and blah, 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 blah. And if they're out, I'm probably okay. And they've usually, you know, even though you panic and you start to, you know, sweat, it's usually somebody who wants to say thank you. You know, if it was a drug case and you set them straight or you cut them a break or whatever. So, that's happened.
Hearing a judge speak her mind in these cases is what makes her show so good. Take this case, for example.
This is the plaintiff, Derek. He says the defendant, his new neighbor, is a menace to the neighborhood, and he's had nothing but problems since he moved in.
The plaintiff, a doughy man with a receding hairline and glasses, lays out his side of the story. His neighbor's tree is growing into his property, and the trunk is causing his fence to bend.
The fence, as far as it being broken, and all of the trees and the limbs and things like that that come over, I'd say 95% of that are coming from her property.
From a tree that she has on her property.
And then it's the defendant's turn. She has a job selling hot dogs from a cart in a parking lot. But she says her neighbor called the city on her, got her kicked out of the parking lot, and she wasn't able to find a new location.
And it was my lifeline. And
called code enforcement because you're not allowed to have that parked in front of your house.
A few years ago, they put a subdivision in, and I found out that they changed it from rural to residential, and it made it, I had to get rid of it.
And then the plaintiff presents as a piece of evidence a video of himself in an argument with his neighbor.
This has to do with Miss Ansley saying that I took her dog while I was out riding with my mother. And you'll just have to excuse the language. I use bad language as well. But if you'd like, I'll play that for you.
I'd like to play,
I have
yes.
two of them.
I live for the moment.
Okay.
He stole my dog, whether you believe him or not. He stole my dog.
Really?
Dog.
Well, where were you?
I was right here.
So it happened in front of you?
You followed your feet and you found her. You stole my dog.
Really? If you yes. saw it, then you should call the cops, you dumb.
You're a mean, mean man.
Really?
Yes, you're mean.
Okay, well, I hope you enjoy the that'll be in your yard from now on, because I'll make sure they in your yard.
That was in May.
Play the second video, please.
Sure. Get the out of my way, you crazy. And you're an ugly. Now get out of here. It goes on from there, but that's the gist of that video.
Stu told me that the key to making a great game show is to get the viewers at home to play along. And at this moment, when this guy presents his evidence, a video of himself stealing his neighbor's dog and calling her a dumb bitch, I totally want to play along at home. I want to be the judge so I can yell at this guy and say, what the fuck are you thinking? Which, of course, is what Judge Million does.
You know, you stand up here with your little three-piece suit and your little files and you're all, Mr., like I've been wrong. And then I hear the real you, and the worst part is you brought me the real you? How do you have this little insight into who you are? Take a good look at yourself when you come home. Take a good look at yourself and ask yourself, is this the person you thought you'd grow up to be? You're crazy. If this is how you spend your time terrorizing a neighbor like this, there is something wrong with you. She's right. You are mean. Don't talk. Just mean. On your lawsuit against her, zero. And for the reasons I've explained, on your counterclaim against him, zero.
Now, if it were my call, I would find in favor of the defendant and her countersuit. To me, it feels morally right to make this bully give back what he took away from this woman by ratting her out to the city and causing her to lose her job selling hot dogs. But that's not how the law works. The verdicts that come down from on high may be legally justified, but they don't always feel morally sound. And Judge Million acknowledges this.
Well, it's annoying, but once you surrender yourself to becoming a judge and doing what's legally correct, you know that that's how you got to go. And then I just explain it. I explain my hands are tied. You've left me no choice because this is what the law says, and that's that. So I don't have a lot of real guilt about that because, you know, that's kind of the social contract we all have to live in a civilized society, that there's a set of rules and everybody agrees that we're going to live by them.
The problem is we don't all play by the same rules. Take the case of the missing sprinkles, for example. Let's just say, for the sake of argument, that the old man decides that instead of taking this kid to small claims court, he's going to sue him. And he has the money to hire a great lawyer. But the kid doesn't have that kind of money. So he tries to represent himself. And as a result, he loses and is forced to pay this man back for the glasses that he broke. That's why, to me, small claims court seems so pure, so close to living up to the ideals of the justice system. There's no attorneys, no jury, just your word and your evidence against the other person, and an overly transparent judge who says exactly what's on her mind. That's the real appeal of the People's Court. It's an idealized version of justice, except it's not real. Before contestants appear on the show, they agree to drop their cases and enter into what's called private arbitration. It basically means the participants agree to pay whatever the judge says, except they don't really. Because they're paid to be on television, they don't actually pay the damages out of their own pockets. But when the bullies of the world appear on television and get yelled at and told to pay up, it's fun to play along at home, to feel like you're witnessing the evil get what they deserve, even though it's nothing more than an elaborately created fantasy. This story was produced by me, David Weinberg, with help from Carla Green. It was edited by Sonia Geis and Nick White and mixed by Lyra Smith. Technical direction from JC Swatek. Executive producer is Sonia Geis, and Gary Scott is KCRW's program director. If you like the show, please help us spread the word. Tell your friends. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts. It really helps. I also made a Spotify playlist for the show's official soundtrack. You can find the details on that at kcrw.com/welcometoLA. Thank you so much for listening. Next time on Welcome to LA, a story of romance, heartbreak, and a magic potato.
Always have a slice of potato in there with your underwear, and it will help you, and you'll see.
Thanks so much for listening. See you next week.